Welcome, everyone. This is a day of a few more overviews from organizations that will commonly come before this committee, hoping that this is of particular assistance to members who did not serve on the Labor and Consumer Protection Division in the past biennium. Representative Mahoney, have you had the time to review the minutes from our previous meeting?
Yes.
Excellent. Would you... Representative Mahoney moves approval of the minutes from the January 16th, 2009 meeting. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Mahoney. First organization to present is the Legal Services Advocacy Project. Mr. Elwood, if you'd please come forward, identify yourself for the tape and proceed, and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You'll have to excuse me. I'm battling a little hoarseness here, so I'll do my best not to annoy everybody with my voice today, or what I say. I'm Ron Elwood. I'm with the Legal Services Advocacy Project, and for many of you, of course, know me and know the organization. We've been around for about 30 years doing advocacy work here at the Capitol. For the new members who may not know about us, we are the group that represents legal aid in Minnesota. Legal aid, of course, being the organization that provides the free legal assistance to low-income Minnesotans and represents and provides advice in legal matters where they're unable to afford a lawyer to make sure that our societal goal of equal access to justice is fulfilled. And the Legal Services Advocacy Project is a very tiny group of folks, a unit of legal aid that is spends their time up here working on public policy issues that affect low-income Minnesotans. Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to provide some insight and an overview of the key issues that we would like to bring forward this year. And before your committee. So what I'm going to do is talk about three major issues. I'll go into a little detail on two of them and kind of be pretty brief on the third. The three are tackling the problems that have arisen in what is known as the debt settlement industry. The second is the issue of payday lending, which is prevalent here in Minnesota and around the country. And the third is an issue that we believe would come to the committee, probably go to judiciary first or civil justice first, but will likely come here. It's an issue dealing with restoring consumers' rights to take a private action when they've been defrauded, which has been essentially removed by the court in a case of several years ago. So I'll describe that in brief, but I'll take a very short time on that. I'd like to talk to you first about the debt settlement industry. For those of you who are not familiar with this or this term or this industry, if you watch late night TV and you see the ads that say, "Are you in debt? And we can help you by settling your debt for 50 cents on the dollar," or something like that. And we'll get you out of debt and we'll get the creditors off your back. That's the industry that we're talking about. 2 years ago, Representative Dabney, Chair Dabney, carried a bill that put some regulation around a similar but significantly different type of animal called debt management. The debt management industry is an industry that, where it's done correctly, is designed to repay the debt by having a third-party intermediary, typically a credit counseling agency like Lutheran Social Services, manage the individual's finances, work as an intermediary with the creditors, accept the monthly payment from the debtor, and then in turn pay it off to the creditors. The bottom line being that it's intended to repay the debt and ultimately help restore people's credit. Debt settlement is very, very different. Debt settlement intent is to cut a deal with creditors to pay significantly less than what they owe. And there are a lot of problems with this. There's been about a 300% increase in the businesses doing this kind of practices There are now more than 1,000 businesses doing this throughout the country. As far as I know, there is no business doing this type of service that is domiciled here in Minnesota. As I said, the debt settlers promised to negotiate with creditors on debtors' behalf to settle the debt for cents on the dollar. The Federal Trade Commission has identified pervasive problems, shady and abusive business practices associated with this industry. I was at an FTC workshop on September 25th, at which the American Bankers Association, American Express, members of the debt settlement industry, and consumer advocates were there. And I can tell you that in your packet you have a press release from the FTC regarding an action, one of the many, many, many actions they've taken against these types of businesses. And I'd just like to draw your attention to, at least in this particular instance, one of the findings in that action is the percentage of people that actually follow through and complete these kinds of programs. They're typically 12 to 36 month programs where the industry will advise the debtor to stop paying bills, accumulate a significant amount of money so that the debt settlement negotiator will have the opportunity to cut a deal with the creditors. Essentially, we've got you where we want you. We can pay you $10,000. You owe us $20,000, but settle the debt, and we've got this amount of money. So it takes quite a while to accumulate that kind of money. Of course, the question that always pops into people's minds is, if you could accumulate $10,000 over 3 years, why aren't you paying your creditors? But that's a question that goes unanswered. But if you notice in the FTC press release, the number of clients and the number of clients that actually completed the program. I'll do the math for you. It's 1.4%. There are many states that actually ban this type of practice. And 6, I believe, make it a crime for a for-profit entity to provide this kind of service. At the workshop in Washington, American Express testified that they do not deal with debt settlers. They will not even talk to these folks. The American Bankers Association spokesperson there called this type of practice harmful and not useful at all. Debt settlement is completely unregulated in the state of Minnesota. I'm sure what you're going to hear from the industry as we go forward on this bill is that this is a legitimate option for debtors. Few bad apples make it bad for everybody. Don't overregulate us. Conversely, you're going to hear from the Attorney General's Office and Lutheran Social Services. You will hear testimony before your committee of the pervasive abuse of this type of service here in the state of Minnesota. The solution that we will propose is that you enact legislation that requires all debt settlers to be registered with the Minnesota Department of Commerce, like we did with the debt management folks a couple years ago. And similarly, what we did with the managers is to prohibit false and misleading promises and abusive business practices and establish additional consumer protections in the bill, similar to those in the debt management law, but applicable to this type of service, so that the legitimate operators can do business, but the illegitimate operators will be gone. When we passed the bill 2 years ago, there were hundreds of companies, out-of-state companies, dealing with debt management services here in Minnesota with Minnesota consumers. And again, the mission of the debt managers, unlike the debt settlers, is to repay the debt. But since the law was enacted, dozens of companies have registered with the Department of Commerce, and the legislation has done precisely what it was intended to do. It has fenced out the bad guys and allow the legitimate operators to do business here in Minnesota, and that's what our intent is with that settlement. Mr. Chair, would you like me to answer questions with each issue, or do you want me to just go through the whole litany?
If there are questions, any questions for Mr. Elwood? Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Elwood, could you tell, you spoke to states that ban this and make it a crime. Could you repeat those numbers and then actually tell me which states make it a crime?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, I do have a list back in the office of the states that banned them. I don't have them with me today. I will provide them to you. And when we certainly come before the committee, I can, again, we can provide that. But I do believe that six states actually criminalize the activity for a for-profit. They allow the nonprofits to do it, but they criminalize the activity if it's a for-profit providing this kind of service. It's a very risky and very, very shady type of operation when done illegitimately.
Well, and Mr. Chair,
Representative Mahoney,
if you could provide that list of the states that ban it and the states that make it a crime, I'd appreciate it.
Ms. Elwood.
I'd be happy to. Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, I'd be happy to do that. It would be my pleasure.
Any other questions from members regarding debt settlements? Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair, the next issue that we would like to bring to your attention and try to deal with this year is payday lending. There's a lot of information in your packets, and I'll refer to it as I go along. Since 1999, the payday lending law, which is Section 4760 of Minnesota statutes, was enacted in 1995. The Department of Commerce, the first year the Department of Commerce began collecting statistics on the lending activity was 1999. I have looked at those statistics every year since 1999, and I can tell you that there have been more than 1.1 million payday loans since that time made by Minnesota companies here in Minnesota. And there's a chart in your packet that shows the growth of the lending activity. For those of you who are unfamiliar with payday lending, it's the type of short-term, high-interest, small-amount loans that are made by companies. There are about 24 companies around Minnesota that do this type of lending. And typically, you will be lending money against your next paycheck. There's small amounts in the neighborhood of $300, $400, $250, that kind of those kind of numbers. So you'll be coming in on January 1st and asking for a loan for the next 2 weeks. Let's just say you get a $300 loan. You write them a check for $330, let's say. I'm just making up some numbers here, but so $330. They give you $300 in cash. 2 weeks later, you come back and you pay them $330 in cash. They rip up your check. The problem with the loans typically is that once you've paid them back the $330 that you borrowed 2 weeks ago against your paycheck, now that you've gotten your paycheck, what are you going to do for the next 2 weeks? Because you've given back a significant portion of your paycheck. So typically people will take another loan and another loan and another loan and another loan and another loan. And essentially what's happening is folks are borrowing their own money back each 2 weeks, but simply paying the $30 rollover fee over and over and over again. So I want to dispel some myths. You may have heard a variety of things about payday lending, good, bad, and different. But I think there are a lot of myths around there, and I want to dispel that. There's a thing in your packet, myths and facts about payday lending. First thing is that that the interest rates are so high because these are risky loans. That's not true. There's no relationship between rates and risk. As you can see, the default rate, if you talk about it as a percentage of all loans, is 2.1% and 2.3% if you talk about it as a percentage of the money lent. That's about half of what the default rate is on credit cards. This is not a risky loan. As we said before, the myth is that these are one-time, short-term, emergency loans just to help somebody out of a jam. You'll hear over and over and over again, the car broke down, I need to get fixed, I can't pay for it. They may start out as that, but they don't end up that way. Because the real problem here is the debt trap. Of the states that collect such data, what we do know is this. 90% of borrowers take 5 or more loans out a year. 61% of borrowers take 12 or more loans out a year, and 24% of borrowers take 21 or more loans out a year. Now, the industry will tell you, these APRs, everybody argues APR is so high, but it's 390% under the payday lending statute. You can't apply an APR to a two-week loan. And you know what? They're absolutely right. If they took one loan and went away, or took two loans a year, came back 6 months later, we wouldn't be sitting here. But with these numbers, you can see that this is not a one-time, short-term emergency loan. These borrowers wind up in long-term lending and borrowing relationships with these lenders. When you're taking 20 loans a year, all of a sudden those APRs start looking pretty darn good and pretty applicable. The other myth that I think we need to dispel here is that this is an urban phenomenon. It's only inner city. If you look at the last set of facts there, you might be surprised to learn that since 1999, of the 1.1 million loans that were made, more than half were made in the suburbs. And almost a third were made in rural Minnesota, and only 16% were made in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Many states, actually also the Department of Defense, has called these loans predatory. And several years ago asked Congress to limit the interest rates on payday lending to military personnel to 36% APR because of the devastating effect that these loans were having on military families and their financial circumstances. And Congress did just that. Anywhere in America, including Minnesota, if you are a military personnel or a family member of a military personnel, you walk into a payday lender, they can't charge you more than 36%. Many states have taken the same route and limited the lending rate to 36% APR, or outright just kicked them out and banned them.
Mr. Elwood, one moment. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's our rate?
Mr. Elwood.
Representative Mahoney, Chair Dabney, Representative Mahoney. Well, it depends. If you're lending under the payday lending statute 4760, and there's a chart that I have in the in your packet which says APR's payday lending law, you'll see, for example, for a $100 loan under the under the payday lending statute, the interest rate is 390%. You'd be surprised to know that's among the lowest rates in the area and around the country. But another problem that I was about to identify for you is that the largest lenders in Minnesota, the lenders that provide about 60% of the loans, have discovered a loophole in the law. And what they have been able to do is incorporate as industrial loan and thrift companies under Chapter 53 of our banking statutes, and as such obtain authority to lend under those another section of law, 4759. And the APR for the same $100 loan for those folks they can charge is 685%. And what does the consumer get for the difference? Not a thing. It's exactly the same thing. And in fact, there's also under the loophole section an opportunity for those lenders, if they structure this as a line of credit, which many have done, or some have done, I should say, there's an additional $50 fee that they can charge, which translates on a $100 loan with everything to 1,988%. Now, to be fair, I have heard from the industry members that they typically do not charge the $50, or they don't charge all of the $50. So, they have represented that to me, and I believe them. But they do have the legal authority under the statute to charge that amount. And thank you for that question. Many states have banned these things or have limited the interest rates such that it's an effective ban, because the 36% interest rate essentially puts these folks out of business. You may be interested to know that this election cycle, the legislatures in Arizona and Ohio limited the interest rates down to 28 and 36% respectively. I'm not exactly sure, but essentially capped those rates at a very low rate. The industry, and there is some information in your packet, some articles about this, both in Arizona and Ohio, the industry mounted referenda to overturn the legislature's enactment of these restrictive bans. You might be surprised to know that the voters in both states resoundingly voted against the industry. In Arizona, it was 60-40 against the payday lending industry, and in Ohio, it was 65-35% against the industry. So the voters said, keep the restrictions in place and essentially don't let the door hit you on the way out. So in Minnesota, we have two huge problems with payday lending. One, as I mentioned, is this loophole. We think it is just unconscionable to charge that much for the same loan when the law was designed in 1995, the payday lending loan, which is the payday lending law, which is formerly known as the Consumer Small Loan Act. We colloquially call it the payday lending law. But that was intended to govern this type of transaction. So the largest lenders, and 60% of the loans now are made under the loophole. The other big issue is the debt trap. Now, what I also want to point out is what you're going to hear from the industry in response to our attempt to fix these problems. You're going to hear there's a vital service. People can't get credit anywhere else. You're going to hear that it's needed now more than ever in this critical crunch, credit crunch. You're going to hear that they already offer voluntary repayment plans. You're going to hear if you try to regulate us more, we're not going to be able to offer these kind of loans anymore. You're going to hear that we're really a one-time emergency loan. We're not interested in trapping people into long-term debt. And you're going to hear that studies show that there are ill effects when you ban these payday loans. Well, I can tell you that there are studies on both sides. We can sit here for a couple of months with dueling studies. And they're all by very legitimate people. People from the Federal Reserve have come out in favor of payday loans. The North Carolina Banking Commissioner has come out against it. Studies that will show you that they lead to bankruptcy. Studies that will show you they lead to more bounced checks. So, I mean, we can each arm ourselves with the academic information. But what I can tell you from North Carolina's study, which was really a survey, I should say, because I don't want to mischaracterize. It was a survey by the Banking Commission. But what they found when they kicked the payday lenders out of the state was that it, in fact, fostered personal responsibility. Because think about it. If you're in trouble and you need money for the next payday, are you going to call your creditor? Most people are really, they don't want to do that. Are you going to ask your friends? Are you going to ask your family for money? Are you going to reveal that you have financial problems when it's easy to walk down the street to a friendly person who's happy to give you $300 and charge you 390%? People know what they're getting into. They know they're paying all this money. It's not, the disclosure's there. That's not the issue. The issue is it's easy. And what the North Carolina study showed, a survey showed, is that when they didn't have that opportunity, people actually faced up to their responsibilities. Were there bounce checks? Of course there were some of them. But more people said, now I have to call my creditor and actually work something out. I'm going to go ask my family. I'm going to ask my friends to try to get me out of this short-term emergency and pay them back. They're going to face up to their personal problems and take on the personal responsibility instead of going the easy route. So when you see, I have another thing in the pack, another item in the pack that I want to show you. You're going to hear that if we regulated the industry, heavily regulated, so they're not going to be able to make loans anymore. If we got them back under the payday lending law that most of the firms who are not big enough to become a bank of industrial loan and thrift still have to operate under, 25 of the 28, or no, that's not true, that's not true. About 23 of the 28 payday lenders continue to operate under the payday lending statute. The problem is the biggest ones have skipped under the loophole. But you have Payday America is the biggest lender in Minnesota, payday lender in Minnesota. They have over 50% of the market share. There's a chart in your packet. It says Payday America loans before discovering the loophole. Now, they're going to come here and tell you that if you make them go back under 4760, the payday lending law, they're not going to be able to make loans. And I wonder how they can say that in the face of this chart, which shows you how many loans they made before they discovered the loophole. I just don't think that that's a credible argument, frankly, in the face of these facts. But I have to tell you, in closing, what your the issues in this arena that you're going to have to grapple with this year are both legal and moral. First, should a few companies be allowed to continue to exploit the loophole that allows them to charge 685% for a $100 loan when the payday lending law caps the loans at 390% and 90% of the businesses continue to lend under that law? Second, is the potential benefit for a few who use these types of loans the way they were intended, is that benefit worth the risk and the harm to the majority of folks who wind up getting trapped in these things and can't get out? I always like to think of the old song, The Hotel California. You can check out, but you can never leave. And finally, is it a credible assertion that their mission is altruistic, to provide short-term emergency loans, to step into a void, to help people for over short-term emergencies, when the facts really argue that the business model here is to keep people coming back week after week after week after week after week? Those are the issues you're going to have to deal with. We're going to come to you with a bill that's going to try to address some of these problems. And Mr. Chair, with that, I think I've spoken long enough, and I'm going to stop.
Thank you very much. Any other questions for Mr. Elwood? Mr. Elwood, thank you. Next on our agenda is, if I can find the agenda, thank you, Ms. Jerry Katz from the Service Employees International Union. Ms. Katz, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape and begin.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jerry Katz. I'm with the SEIU Minnesota State Council. And SEIU unites 30,000 members in Minnesota and 2 million members in North America. In Minnesota, SEIU represents hospital, clinic, and nursing home workers, public school service employees, including paraprofessionals, clerical staff, bus drivers, custodians, and food service workers, as well as janitors, window cleaners, and private security officers. So our core legislative priorities at the state level this year can roughly be broken down into about three categories: healthcare reform, public education, and addressing the budget shortfall. And probably the piece of our agenda that would come before your committee is one of our healthcare priorities, which is the Health Families Act. And that's a bill that will be authored by Representative Lesch and in the Senate by Senator Anderson. And currently, 40% of Minnesota workers receive no paid sick leave, and so this bill would require employers to pay 1 hour of paid sick leave for every 40 hours worked, and small employers, so those with fewer than 10 employees, would pay 1 hour for every 80 hours worked. And that sick leave could also be used for a person to care for a family member. And legislation like this has already passed in San Francisco and Milwaukee. I think we would be the first state to pass that legislation. We're also working on a number of healthcare reform bills that are dedicated to making sure that every man, woman, and child in Minnesota has access to high-quality, affordable healthcare. We are working to make sure that our public schools are funded adequately. And then finally, we're going to urge the legislature and the governor to address the budget crisis in a balanced manner, both by raising revenue and with cuts. We understand that we can't tax our way out of the situation, but we also can't cut our way out of the situation. And so we'll be fighting for a balanced approach that will ultimately make the tax system more fair. I wanted to also let you know that about our the fact that our legislative priorities are very closely tied to our goals surrounding organizing and negotiating better contracts for our members. And there are a number of contract campaigns underway in 2009. Really briefly, I'll just run through those. Right now, we're working on negotiating a contract with the Regina Medical Center in Hastings. And there was a successful two-day unfair labor practice strike there a few weeks back, and more than 230 nursing assistants, physical therapy aides, x-ray aides, housekeepers, dietary workers, medical transcriptionists, operating room aides, patient care technicians, and other caregivers are now planning their next steps. Their issues are retirement security and affordable health care. So that that is going on right now. Coming up in February, the Twin Cities multi-employer hospital contract will expire, and this contract affects workers at Fairview Southdale in Edina, Fairview Riverside in Minneapolis, St. John's in St. Paul, Methodist Hospital in St. Louis Park, North Memorial in Robbinsdale, Children's in Minneapolis, Children's in St. Paul, and Bethesda Hospital in St. Paul. There's also the contract for the St. Mary's Hospital in Rochester expires in September, and all of these healthcare workers are represented by SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. The Twin Cities janitor's contract expires on December 31st, and those are workers represented by Local 26. The Minneapolis Public School custodian's contract expires in June, and those are workers represented by Local 63. And then 76 other school employee contracts are going to expire over the course of 2009, and those are contracts covering custodians, bus drivers, food service, paraprofessionals, and clerical workers represented by Local 284. And then finally, we're also devoting a lot of effort to passing healthcare reform and labor law reform at the federal level, and we'll be supporting the passage of the Employee Free Choice Act at a federal level to make it easier for workers to have a voice at the workplace, and also will strengthen measures against corporations who try to intimidate or fire workers who try to form a union. So those are our priorities for this session, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today.
Any questions for Ms. Capp? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Last on the agenda today is Mr. Edward Reynoso from the Teamsters. Welcome. Please state your name for the tape and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Edward Reynoso, and I will try to keep it as short as Jerry did. As many of you may be aware, Teamsters Joint Council 32, which represents approximately 56,000 members in the state of Minnesota, had proposed, or actually was worked with legislators last year to pass legislation addressing one particular thing, and that's the independent contractor misclassification. And we had legislation that was passed before this committee on a unanimous basis, reached the House floor and was passed on the House and passed in the Senate, subsequently vetoed by the governor, unfortunately. Well, we've come back again this year, and we're hoping to work with the legislature and this committee again in addressing what we feel is a very, very important issue, and an issue that that is really taking advantage of workers in our state. We put together this Teamsters Joint Council 32 Independent Contractors Goal, which many of you have a copy of, and we feel this four-point effort in order to address the issue of independent contractors in our state and the abuse of what's going on at this point. We feel that establishing a strong universal definition of an employee is very important. Unfortunately, in our opinion, the six-point criteria that an independent contractor in the trucking industry has to qualify now is vague at best. In the legislative audit report that was released in November of 2006 stated that many of these employers want a method that's easy to determine whether an employee is an employee or an independent contractor. So we feel using this ABC test, which you have also a copy of, would certainly allow an employer to easily determine whether they in fact have an employee or an independent contractor. The legislative audit report released in November of 2006 also stated that there has to be an enhanced collaboration within all three departments, Department of Revenue, Department of Employment and Economic Development, and Department of Labor and Industry. Unfortunately, right now, as it stands from my understanding, is that the three departments really don't communicate when it comes to determining or findings during audits when somebody's been determined as misclassifying employees. So our goal is to hopefully have legislation that addresses that problem. The third is empowering workers to go to any one of the three departments and find a determination, have the department give them a determination without fear of retribution. The way it happens now, basically, is that an employee, first of all, very few employees are going to have the goal to go up to any one of the three departments for fear of retribution. What happens now is if an employee feels that they may be misclassified, the first thing one of these three departments are going to do is contact the employer, and obviously that will get back to the employer as to who's asking for the audit. The other thing is many of these employees aren't going to ask for a determination while they're working for these employers and don't realize that they can actually do this now. So we hope to work with the departments, with this legislation, that the departments will allow these so-called independent contractors to go in and get determination through them without fear of retribution from a company. The last, the fourth point of this legislation that we hope we could get legislature to address is increased enforcement. The legislative audit report specifically said that there really isn't a problem in the trucking industry. But the unfortunate thing is it didn't mention how many audits were actually done in the trucking industry. Nor do we know through the audit report itself. So with that being said, we have information that there has been several audits through the Department of Employment and Economic Development this last year, and that one of the major employers that we were really trying to address was found guilty of misclassifying their employees. Now, this is an employer that operates throughout the country. And some would say, well, if we found them guilty of misclassifying employees, well, the system is working, the determining factors are working. That's just one of hundreds of hundreds of companies that operate in our state that are misclassifying their employees. We don't know unless they're audited. And so we feel that if the departments will take a concerted effort in auditing companies that are knowingly violating the laws in other states and jurisdictions, that it will increase the ability for employees to have their rights in the state. So with that, we have another issue. If you would like me to answer questions now, Mr. Chairman, or...
Any questions for Mr. Reynoso on the employee classification issue? Seeing none. Continue, please.
And let me just add to that. Just remember that you're going to have other organizations that have come up, and I know of one organization that John Gertesmeyer and I, the director also of Teamsters Joint Council 32 Political Program, have met with, and you're going to have other organizations come up and say that... they have an answer to this legislation the way it is now. To add a seventh point that was originally taken out would fix the problem. They aren't working. The only people that are benefiting from the language the way it is set now is companies that have found loopholes in exploiting this set of guidelines or this model of independent contractors for exploiting workers. The audits are working that they're going to say, which obviously, in our opinion, there aren't enough audits. And third, it's going to be a huge burden for some of these companies to hire legal counsel in order to defend themselves on this, and it's going to hurt small business in the state. We feel that whether it's a big business or a small business, if they're violating the law, it needs to be addressed. And that... Last thing to probably say is that it's going to hurt jobs in this economy that's very volatile, and that it's going to hurt workers. I can assure you, if anything, it's going to help our companies that are operating in the correct manner to put them on a level playing field, such as the legislative audit report stated. On the average, they said on a $30 an hour wage, somebody that misclassifies their employees saves about $7.32 an hour. That's a huge savings. And the other thing is that as legislation such as this is coming forward, and we've learned this in the construction industry, that as we have legislation that addresses the independent contractors, these companies are looking for more loopholes. And they are in the language that was passed just recently, a couple of years ago, addressing independent contractors in the construction industry. Now, many of these employers apparently are going to these employees and telling them to go file for independent corporation, to file as a corporation. And now they're not independent contractors. They're filing as a corporation. So as we evolve and try to address this issue, the companies are also evolving and looking for more loopholes. So we hope we can address that issue. Now, this next issue is something that we feel is important to activate our membership and get them involved in politics. We have a nonpartisan political PAC that we ask our members to contribute to. And right now there's no language in the state that allows them to who contribute on a volunteer basis through their payroll deduction. And we're hoping to get legislation to address that and pass legislation through this committee or other committees in this legislature to allow state employees, county and local government employees to contribute to a nonpartisan PAC and get actively involved. So these are just two of the many things that we'll be working alongside with other labor organizations, whether it's AFL or many of our friends and partners.
Any questions for Mr. Renoso? With that, Mr. Renoso, thank you very much for coming in today and presenting Teamsters' agenda. We stand adjourned. Thank you, members. Thank you, staff.